So, welcome back to the London Architect, everyone. This is episode number 6, I believe. And today we have Rachel Marshall with us. She is an access consultant. Hi, Rachel. Would you like to introduce yourself?
Thanks, Lily. Yes, I'm an access and inclusive design consultant, and I have been for quite a few years. It must be getting on for 20 years now. Mm-hmm. And I have my own company called With an A Projects. Work on lots of different buildings and doing a small but very important part.
Yes. So we've got lots of questions for you. First of all, I remember from our pre-meet chat, you explained how at first you wanted to be an architect.
Yeah.
And then you sort of, by luck, found your way to where you are now in access consultancy. Could you explain that a little bit?
Yes. So you're quite right. I always wanted to do architecture. That's what I studied at university. Mm-hmm. So I started studying in 1992. Mm-hmm. Took a bit of a deviation from, some people go straight through it. After 3 years, I'd almost finished my degree and I dropped out.
Was it the stress of it, or because I know a lot of people struggle with it. Yeah.
I really struggled in that year.
Yeah.
Ended up doing quite a few different jobs, but eventually was working in a public relations firm that turned out to be next to, in a business centre, next to mm-hmm. my future boss. Only I didn't know it at that point.
Yeah.
So I knew David for about 6 years while I was doing that job. And during that time, I really wanted to get back into architecture as well. So go back to university and also get a job in practice.
Mm-hmm.
All of that came about at once. Mm-hmm. And so I returned to repeat a lot of the third year at London Met. In the same week, that's when I first started working in practice as well, in a little practice up in North London. And I mean, David Bonnet was one of my biggest encouragers to do that. He was really keen for me to sort of get back on track with what I wanted to do after sort of losing my nerve all those years before. So went back to university, started working for a practice. I was there for two years, I think. And one of the university projects was, one of the modules I did was about evaluating a building in terms of parts K, L and M of the building regulations.
Yeah.
And so I got in touch with David, this chap who used to work next door to me. And I just asked him whether I could come and have a word with him about this project, find out in a bit more detail about how he does stuff and everything. Got a really good mark for the project, sent him a note saying thank you.
Yeah.
And then he sent me a note back saying, if you're ever looking to change jobs, then get in touch. Mm-hmm. And so I did. And in the meantime, so while I was still working at the PR agency, I'd started getting these really odd physical symptoms.
Mm-hmm.
And this involved going to see a neurologist, having lots of tests, lots of scans. They came to the conclusion that it was either stress or it was a sort of recurring version of multiple sclerosis.
Mm-hmm.
So that was quite daunting at the time.
Yeah.
But it was because of that that I discovered the MS Society.
Mm-hmm.
And it was the quite early days of the internet back then. And also BBC In Touch, which was on the very early BBC website.
Mm-hmm.
And also they had an audio programme. And there was another couple of things. And I just started to notice, especially because some of these symptoms that I was getting meant that I was temporarily disabled.
Yeah.
So that sort of stuck with me, and then that kind of gave me the motivation to want to work both in architecture and with making the environment more accessible.
Yeah.
And that's what I've been doing ever since, really.
Nice. Well, you now work for yourself.
Yes,
With an A
Projects.
Project.
Yeah.
And Could you just explain for our listeners again how that came about, the name with an A? Because we were just speaking about that and it's quite a funny and interesting way of coming up with your own business name.
Oh, gosh, yeah. I mean, I'd been thinking about setting up my own business for quite a while. I didn't want it to be my name. But I some friends have known me for years as with an A, and mm-hmm. one in particular who still sends postcards from far-flung places mm-hmm. addressed to with an A, and it's because I've got an extra A in my first name, so it's spelt like Michael. But if you try and explain that to people they still get confused.
Yeah.
So some friends started calling me Rachel with an A to distinguish me from Little Rach, and well, Big Rach. I didn't want to be known as Big Rach.
Of course, yeah.
So, yes, and one of these postcards or a letter arrived while I was trying to choose the name. My mum looked it up on, looked it up on the internet, and she was like, oh, Rachel, that's a cat food manufacturer. but I decided that I would add the projects and still go with it.
So currently you live in Hertfordshire.
That's right.
But yes, you do projects sort of all over?
I do, yes. A lot in London. Mm-hmm. And I'm working on Tully House in Carlisle at the moment, which is a enormous museum and art gallery that's started from being quite a stately townhouse kind of thing, and has just evolved and been added to over the years. Mm. There's also a project currently being built in Holyhead, and that's the Ucheldra, or Ucheldra, some people pronounce it Ucheldra, but it's an arts centre that's in a former convent.
Okay.
On Holyhead.
Where is Holyhead?
It's right on the northwest tip of Wales.
Right, okay.
So, it's an amazing little town.
Yeah.
I recommend it.
So I wanted to ask, have you ever had a project where you've gone there and you've had a look first off and been like, oh my God, this is going to be a nightmare to try and, you know, like, this is so medieval, I have no idea. Like, does that ever happen?
Normally, they're the kind of projects that get me really excited.
Yeah,
so, challenge. Absolutely. The buildings that have been, or the projects that have been problematic, it's usually to do with the attitudes of the people involved.
Mm-hmm.
That's the tricky bit. That's where you have to sort of really make the case for accessibility, even though it's still, yes, it's a requirement, but also it's important to go that extra distance to make it not just meet the building regulations in the most minimum way that the building needs to, which of course mm-hmm. does vary according to the particular circumstances of the building. But because we've got the Equality Act as well, so the Equality Act 2010 was a part of a bunch of anti-discrimination legislation that got brought together,
mm-hmm.
Which included the Disability Discrimination Act. And so that is kind of the human rights legislation rather than, so it doesn't say, you know, it's the building mix that says like steps should be between, have a rise of between 150 and 170
yeah.
or whatever. That's about the dimensional stuff of the building. The Equality Act is about not discriminating it. So it has a lot of implications for the built environment of a service provider, of an employer,
mm-hmm.
All of these places where discrimination might come into play, and you'd hope it wouldn't, but it isn't kind of prescriptive about buildings.
Yeah.
So that's quite often the conversation that I have to have mm-hmm. to make sure that people understand, okay, if you just do this, you know, whatever it might be to improve the access, yes, you've sort of fulfilled that part of the access of the building regulations
mm-hmm.
and you've made your building accessible. But to make it inclusive,
mm-hmm.
then this is what you should do. And it is much more of a holistic way of looking at a building and what buildings do and how they should support us, because it's also about the management of the building. It's about the staff training.
Yeah.
And it's about changing attitudes, basically, towards disabled people.
Yeah.
So
And it must be sort of not just disabilities that you can see as well. I know that's like a big thing.
Absolutely.
How do you approach that kind of aspect of it?
It's been made a whole lot easier recently by the publication of PAS 6463, which doesn't sound like the most easy document name to remember, but it stands for Publicly Accessible Standard. Mm-hmm. And 6463 on a telephone keypad spells out MIND. So this is a version of a British standard that pulls together for the first time all the kind of advice and guidance and knowledge about how to meet the needs of people with neurodivergent conditions, neuroprocessing differences, how they can be supported in the built environment.
Yeah.
So, and it's a wonderful document. I learned so much when I was reading it, and it makes it so much easier because you can point to a standard, you know, in this British standards publication written by experts, and say, well, look, if you look here, you can see, you know, whereas before it was like, well, you might want to think about doing that differently. Like before, on my word or based on my knowledge, I might be able to point to a particular organisation's website for some guidance about, for instance, designing for autistic people or designing for children with special needs or something.
Yeah.
But now it's all come together in this document. It's great.
Well, I can't believe that there wasn't something like this that existed already. So it was really down to you sort of having that intel on what you think is appropriate.
Yeah, sort of. And also because there's always specialisms within what we do. So I sort of would know who in the industry might know a little bit more about neuroprocessing differences. Jean, an industry colleague, she was the kind of author and sort of lead of the steering group for that project. Mm-hmm. And so she became the person that the rest of us would ask. And, you know, and now we can start disseminating that information. Like, it's free to download. And anyone listening really should.
Okay.
Go. But the good thing is about it being the knowledge coming together in a PAS is that hopefully it will make its way either into an existing British standard or into its own British standard.
Yeah.
And then the British standards have quite an influence on what happens with the building regulations.
Mm-hmm.
So it's kind of like...
It's a step-by-step process. Yeah. And exactly. It must bring a lot of attention to the role of an access consultant as well.
Yes. Yeah,
so do you think that will be kind of helping the access consultancy make its way into more mainstream
industry? I think we are pretty mainstream now in terms of people. Over the time that I've been working in access, there's a much more positive attitude to accessibility and I think towards disabled people as well.
Mm-hmm.
Thankfully, it's by no means perfect.
Yeah.
And the built environment is by no means perfect as well. But the attitudes have changed. I remember going into meetings years ago and architects would say, like, well, we know we should do this, but how can we get around that?
Mm.
And I'd be like, well, hang on, it's a new building, first of all. What's your justification for not doing it?
Yeah.
And you just know that there's sort of this ignorance about disabled people.
Yeah.
And this kind of, and I think it used to be the case that people just weren't aware of visibly disabled people being out and about. Part of the reason for that was because the environment wasn't accessible, then it wasn't possible to be, for instance, a teacher who uses a wheelchair.
Yeah.
And that's so much about the environment causing the problem. But also it meant that visibly disabled people just weren't as visible as they would have been
yeah.
if the environment had been accessible. So yeah. that, thank goodness, is changing now.
Yeah.
And quite often when I do CPDs or the first time I talk to a new design team, I give them a sort of little sort of introduction to the subject and kind of how my work will kind of mesh into the design team process, if you like. Yeah. And I do often say to them, you know, well, one of the things is like how many people, I ask around the room, how many people in the population are disabled?
Mm-hmm.
And I get all sorts of, but you could immediately tell the people who've got a bit of knowledge or read up on it, mm-hmm. or like, because it is 19 to 20%.
Really?
Yes, it's one in five people.
I literally had no idea what to think.
I should have asked you, shouldn't I?
Yeah, you should have tried it on me.
But what I usually say is that, like, you know, that on the way home from whatever meeting or going about their day, I said, I bet you'll start noticing people now, and also start noticing people, how people navigate the environment.
Yeah. Well, it just shows how concerned people are with themselves and that they aren't really looking
true.
At, you know.
Yeah, yeah. And, oh, that's a big issue. People using phones and walking along the street.
Yeah.
I have had to advise a couple of years ago on a project where it was a street that had undergone quite a lot of development and it had got curbs.
Mm-hmm.
But because the street had been done up quite smartly with, you know, nice fancy paving and everything, people were just like wandering across this street on their phones and tripping over the curbs. So it's not visually impaired people or people with visual impairments. It's not people necessarily with balance issues or coordination issues. It's people just striding along, staring at their phones and not taking any notice of their environment.
So that's something that you have to think about.
Oh, yeah.
That is crazy. Yeah, yeah. Yeah. Like the way the world is changing like that. People are actually causing themselves more problems just by...
Exactly. Yep. By not keeping an eye on where they're going.
Yeah. Wow. That is quite interesting. So I wanted to ask you what you think a typical misconception about your role is or misunderstanding about your role.
Yeah. I think... slightly skewing the question, what came to mind when I was thinking about this was it was more a misconception about the disabled population.
Yeah.
And that is that the huge majority of disabled people are wheelchair users.
Mm-hmm.
And that's not the case.
Yeah.
I mean, one of the reasons for that is that the International Symbol for Accessibility, the stick user using, not a stick user, a stick person using a wheelchair.
Yeah.
So that's literally used all the way around the world to signify accessibility.
Yeah.
But it is problematic because it means that some disabled people or people with luggage or children or any other reason who might find a wheelchair accessible toilet much more convenient, and they are absolutely allowed to use a wheelchair accessible toilet.
Yeah.
They are still officially called in the regulations a wheelchair accessible toilet.
Yeah.
And it still has a wheelchair user as a sign on the front.
Mm.
But that has been a problem in the past because it means that, you know, a person who, for instance, has a guide dog, and obviously needs extra space there, or has a small child with them, and all of these things. So that is problematic, and that's quite topical at the moment because there has just been a big international competition about redesigning the international symbol,
okay,
which I think is really exciting.
Yes.
And the entries, there's a website with all the entries on. And it's quite fascinating.
Can you see them?
Okay. Yes. Yeah.
So what kind of thing can you explain or describe for our listeners?
Oh, gosh. Yeah. There seem to be a split between things that represented people in some way.
Mm-hmm.
So the idea of a figure or figures and a symbol that's more like an abstract shape that has some meaning to it.
Okay. Yeah.
And I think that's really interesting because when you get into discussions about, you know, the buildings coming towards practical completion, mm-hmm. and their design teams often are trying to pick out the most designery possible male and female and wheelchair user cubicles. Yeah. And my feeling is it's a picture of a toilet. What you need is a picture of the toilet and the word toilet. Mm. Because the more designery those pictograms get, like the male one, the female one, yeah. and then quite often the unisex one,
yeah.
and the wheelchair user one.
Yeah.
It's about the people, and it's about the people who can go in that room rather than about what is in the room.
Yeah.
And that's an important distinction, especially when we know so much more about how people identify.
Yeah.
And the difficulties of also it goes back to what I've just said about the having a wheelchair user as the international symbol of disability.
Yeah.
Or accessibility, I should say.
Yeah.
So you know, which can and does deny people access because they're thinking, well, I'm not a wheelchair user, so I can't go in there.
Yeah, and it must sort of cause judgment for people that want to use those facilities yeah. if they don't look exactly like, you know, that image that we have ingrained in our mm-hmm. minds of a person in a wheelchair as a disabled, yep. as the only yep. kind of type of disabled person.
Exactly.
Then that's going to cause, some problems
exactly.
there. So another question I had for you was, we might have kind of covered this a little bit, mm-hmm. but what is a major challenge that you have faced during your career and how have you overcome that?
So I'm not going to name the project, but mm-hmm. it was quite an early one that I did. And it was a group of listed buildings, mm-hmm. all interconnected, mm-hmm. central London, all interconnected on different levels. Amazing.
Yeah.
I couldn't wait to get my teeth stuck into that one because it was a really fantastic project.
Yeah.
And we had to work really hard mm-hmm. to make it work in all the ways that this place had to. Mm-hmm. So it was a hotel and restaurant, and the hotel part was new, actually.
Yeah.
So you had to make it the ground floor do so many different things mm-hmm. while optimizing the access. It was extended on the roof as well. And at the ground floor, we worked so hard. I mean, there was a really good team on that project. Mm-hmm. And on a night out, probably a few months after the building had been finished,
yes.
Myself and the architect, mm-hmm. the lead architect from the project, and I think he was the structural engineer, mm-hmm. Because we were meeting up near this building, let's go to the bar in that building.
Yeah.
And so I'm texting my friend walking along the street, you know, looking where I'm going, obviously.
Yes, yes.
Yes. And she said, you know, Rachel, what would you like to drink? And I said, well, I wanted a drink. And she said, you're not going to like it at all, meaning the building.
Oh, no.
And, of course, the interior designers, like once the building was all done and complete and everything, the interior designers had got in there and thought, well, we want to make it like this. So they changed the whole way that the staff, like staff only and public parts of the building worked as the routes between all the parts that people, it was quite complex. And they changed it all.
Yeah.
So there was no longer step-free access from that part of the bar.
And that must be, I mean, not just access consultants, but mm-hmm. architects and, you know, everyone in that sort of industry must face a similar sort of problem going mm-hmm. back and being like, hang on a second, that's not how that's meant to look.
Yeah. It does happen a lot, unfortunately. Yeah.
That is a shame. So could you run us through a sort of a typical working day for yourself? I'm sure no 2 days are the same, but...
And that's why I love it.
Yeah.
It always starts the same way, with a coffee.
Mm-hmm. Nice.
And then as soon as I can, I go out for a walk. Mm-hmm. So today I went off into the fields mm-hmm. of Hertfordshire, which was lovely.
Nice.
Only really a quick walk. And then it tends to be, if I'm not out and about for a meeting or a site visit, then it does tend to be a mixture of reviewing drawings, mm-hmm. Having meetings about new projects, mm-hmm. Having teams calls about particular aspects of a building. Lately, it seems to be all about lifts. I'm getting so many of my projects, they're suddenly going, what about this lift? But can we move this lift to here? And like another one's going, but we saw a building with this lift. Do you think this lift would work? And suddenly it's all about lifts.
Yeah.
And so, yeah, a lot of conversations about lifts lately, mm-hmm. but it's the times when I've got a site visit that I really love.
Yeah.
Or even these days, actually, a meeting in town. Like, we've actually met up. So
yeah.
I'm going to make the most of being in London.
Yeah, it's really nice, isn't it? Yeah. Face-to-face.
Exactly. So, going on a site visit often involves a long train journey or just a short train journey down to London. Mm. And I love seeing buildings when they're actually in use. Of course, it's not always possible, but it makes it much more interesting and sort of easier for me as well to just sit. It's even easier if there's a coffee shop there, because I'll just sit there and like make notes and watch people, you know, interact with the reception staff or like watch them come in and look around because they're like, I don't know where to go.
Yeah.
Can you see a sign? That's really great. All of the buildings are so different. They've all got different challenges.
Yeah.
They might be from the same era, but they've just been used and adapted in so many different ways. So yeah. I really love that.
It must be like kind of crazy how you will have such a different perception of a space to other people. You know, people come in and use that space and they're probably, you know, if they're going in to get a coffee, it's just like, get the coffee, grab it, leave.
Yeah.
Whereas you're sort of watching that whole flow of movement. It must make you a very sort of perceptive person, do you think?
Sort of. I sometimes get laughed at for losing my way in buildings.
Mm-hmm.
And even when I know my way, even when it's a building that I've worked on for years or like that I'm really familiar with, I do tend to lose my way in buildings. And it was relatively recently that someone pointed out to me that it's because you're always looking at the details.
Yeah.
You know, and I will get distracted by all sorts of things, like from the signs on doors to the lack of manifestation on glazed screens to, you know, it could be good things or it could be bad things. But since I realised that, I do make more of an effort to kind of build that mental picture in your head of how the spaces connect again.
Yeah.
Because I do think I get too focused on the details.
Yeah. Well, I want to ask, what did you think of this building when you came in? You know,
Now that's interesting. I did particularly notice.
Yeah.
So for the listeners downstairs, there is quite a fancy looking like bar coffee area with some ceramic sculptury little vases, some shelves with pot plants, lots of pot plants.
Mm-hmm.
I noticed how the pot plants and the other furniture sort of semi-screened the other people sitting there.
Okay.
There were like maybe five or six groups of people on tables, sitting on chairs at tables. And the curtains, the sort of draped curtains around the walls, I thought that was really lovely. And I was trying to work out when you came down, I was trying to work out how much of an impact is that having on the acoustics, because I think the acoustic qualities of a space are so important on so many different levels. And of course, because everyone was so quiet down there, it was really difficult to tell. I wanted to make a noise or something to
test it out.
Something that I really noticed. Revolving doors are not good.
Really?
I used to work with an architect who called them revolting doors.
Oh, why?
Because he really got how inaccessible they were.
Yes, true. I mean, I feel like they're inaccessible for people without disabilities as well. Exactly. Like, I get really confused by them as well.
And I walked up to I saw the revolving door, and then there was another door down here, like to the left of it, that just said automatic door. Of course, I walked up to that and it didn't open. And I was like, and you know what's going on there. It's like someone is sort of supposedly keeping an eye on a camera to look out for anyone who might struggle with the revolving door.
Why wouldn't they just leave it open, though?
Exactly. And that's what they should do.
Yeah.
The doors to the side of revolving doors, which are actually a requirement, should be as equally accessible as the revolving doors.
Yeah.
So if the revolving door is fully automated and starts turning, then the
It should be the
door
same.
To the side should be the same. But the thing is, of course, like, people catch on to the fact that that's a much easier door to go through. So everyone goes through that, and any climatic benefits that you've got by having the revolving door, you've lost, because everyone's coming out of the...
Yeah.
So there are much better doors.
Yeah. Well, I know I tried to sort of avoid the revolving doors, and I've definitely done this like a few times now. Gone up to, like, walked with purpose and confidence up to the other door and trying to look quite like professional and stuff. And then just, you know, when you go for it and it just doesn't work, it's like, okay, this is really embarrassing. Now I'm just going to go for the revolving door instead.
Access and inclusive access should always be as independent as possible.
Yeah.
So it should never be about asking a member of staff to assist you with a door when anyone else could just walk through that door with no...
Because that's just creating another barrier.
Absolutely. Yeah.
So, as a sort of final question, I wanted to ask you... Okay, actually, I've got two, sorry.
Okay, that's fine.
First of all, as an... Okay, I'm going to say architect, because you did do an architecture degree.
But, and the part two.
And yes, exactly. Yes. What would you say your favourite building in London is?
I thought so much about this question, and I went round and round in circles, and I kept going back to the Barbican.
Really?
Because I've got such a strong... I mean, I studied it with my undergrad degree, and went there and did... I think I did acoustic readings of one of the halls there. I've written an article about the refurbishment of the gallery, the art gallery there. I've graduated twice there.
It's got a special place.
And I've worked on it. And I've audited their conservatory for use as a wedding venue.
Yeah.
So, and I'm currently involved with the podium refurb project.
Okay.
Which is all to do with the drainage beneath the Barbican. And anyone who knows the Barbican knows the beautiful sectional perspective that shows how the whole thing fits together.
Yeah.
Oh, it's just wonderful.
So are you a big fan of brutalist architecture?
I am, I think, yes. But I think with the Barbican, it's the ambition of it, it's the uniqueness of it.
Mm-hmm.
It's the uniqueness not only about how interconnected all of those different uses are, it's the scale of it and the whole streets in the sky thing, and it is a, you know, people love it or they hate it, but it's certainly a favorite of mine. But the concrete, and the qualities of the concrete, and like that they created by hand. So even though it's kind of a sort of industrial age building, and its era was very much about and brutalism as well, is about the this honesty and rawness in architecture and in building materials. It's about the handcrafted quality, and it's about the scale of it, not just like the whole the massing of the thing itself, when you've got the balance between the horizontal bits and the vertical bits, and everything else in between, but also right down to the details of like the windows. And then if you've seen an original kitchen in a Barbican flat, it's a beautiful thing.
I wanted to ask if you're a fan of brutalism, have you heard of the Trellick Tower?
Yes.
In Notting I think it's in Notting Hill.
Yes, that sounds right. Yes.
Are you a fan of that?
Yes. Yeah. Goldfinger.
yes, of course.
Well, it's another building with an interesting past and an interesting history.
Yeah.
It's, I mean, Goldfinger was another, I mean, he was so absolutely sure of his, this kind of social, I don't want to say consequences, although they were so sure of like how architecture was going to
impact
change the lives and ordinary lives as well. That's a big thing, because it was when that kind of mass high density housing was built, it was really the first time that architects, not just builders, were involved in building houses.
Yeah.
And so there were all sorts of these ideas about how best to do it, how efficiently. And we're still learning from that process, and we're still in a way, we probably are making similar mistakes, although now, well, now and back then, there's always the problems of the lack of craftsmanship. I mean, you always get good build quality and very poor, and the very poor build quality, especially with regard to housing, has a horrible impact on people's lives. And that's sort of thing that's really got to change.
For our final question, what piece of advice would you give to your younger self?
Ooh, that's a good one. I want to have two pieces of advice, if I can. One is don't lose confidence in yourself, because that's what happened the first time round at university. And the second would be to keep exploring the things that interest you.
Yeah.
I think. And whether that is to do with architecture, to do with access, to do with if... anything, keep exploring and keeping alive those interests, keeping creative, is a really important thing that serves you well as you kind of progress in your career.
Because it gives you confidence in your interests and that you can pursue them.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
That's a good piece of advice. I'm going to take that piece of advice from you.
Very good. I'm glad to hear it.
Well, thank you so much for coming on The London Architect today, Rachel. This has been a really interesting conversation. And you are our first female guest. So congratulations. You should get your medal for that. We've learned a lot. I hope you've enjoyed the experience.
Absolutely.
Thank you to all of our listeners for tuning in again. I hope you find this episode interesting. I certainly have, and there's a lot that I kind of want to follow up on after this. So maybe I'll put some stuff in the comments if anybody wants to have a look for themselves as well. But that's everything for today. So thank you, Rachel, and thank you, listeners. Bye.